welcome.
Shalom and welcome to a new issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Ki Teitse, the Guinness Book of World Torah Records, for having the most mitzvot of any seder in the Torah. There are 54 weekly portions in the Torah, 613 mitzvot distributed in the Torah, not evenly. Do the math, 613 mitzvot divided by 54 weekly sedras should be an average of 11.35 mitzvot per sedra. 11 is the average. Ki Teitse has 74 mitzvot. Next closest is Parshat Emor with 63, then Re'eh with 55, Mishpatim with 53, Kedoshim with 51, and then I think it goes down to 41 for Shofetim. 74 mitzvot in this week's parsha. I have a few thoughts to share with you on mitzvot. We will use mitzvot from Parsha Ki Teitse as examples, and hopefully a picture will emerge. It's a topic that I think is quite subtle by nature, but I feel very, very strongly about the idea and the concept, and we'll get there shortly. In the meantime, the calendar tells us that it is the seventh day of Elul 5766. The year is winding down or up, as you choose to see it, towards Rosh Hashanah, a mere short 3 weeks from this Friday night Shabbos. It'll be Rosh Hashanah. 5767, Haba Aleinu Letova. Let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130 together, and Achenu, and then we'll get on to the Parsha and the topic of mitzvot. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tehiena Aznecha Kashuvot Lekol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod. Ki imacha haslicha lama'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai ki vata nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael, mi kol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara vashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela l'ora, u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Last show was recorded on the first day of Rosh Chodesh Elul. We started the custom of blowing shofar with the second day, namely last Friday, so we haven't had a chance to blow shofar on the show. Let's do it, and then we'll get down to business. That's pretty much the standard custom for each morning of the weekdays in Elul, except for Erev Rosh Hashanah. You blow just a token, Tekiya, Shivorim Teruah, Tekiya. Okay, here we go. The topic has several different parts, different from each other, but basically all under one theme, as you will see emerge, hopefully. I'm reading now from a Dr. Seuss book, the book is actually his first one from 1937, and To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street is its name. And this two-page spread reads as follows. A band that's so good should have someone to hear it, but it's going so fast that it's hard to keep near it. I'll put on a trailer. I know they won't mind if a man sits and listens while hitched on behind. But now, is it fair? Is it fair what I've done? I'll bet those wagons weigh more than a ton. That's really too heavy a load for one beast. I'll give him some helpers. He needs two, at least. The picture, or let's go back a step, the boy who's telling this story is coming home from school, and he has a very vivid imagination. He sees, I think, a horse pulling a wagon, and that's not good enough. It's too real and plain. So he begins to imagine what he saw on Mulberry Street, with intentions of telling his father that story about what happened on his way home from school. Now, he's got a circus wagon with a circus band decked out with their instruments on the wagon itself, and the wagon is being pulled by an elephant. But as you heard me read the piece here, he decided to attach a trailer that had someone sitting in it, able to listen to the band while it's being pulled along the street. But then he realized that the poor elephant has to schlep not just this wagon with the entire band and their instruments, but also this new trailer with a guy. And he adds two animals, two giraffes, actually, to help. And sitting on the elephant is one of these Raja kind of guys in one of those covered sedan chairs. And that's the picture that I'm up to. I remember the first time I saw it, my mind immediately went to the verse in this week's Torah reading, which says, Lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav. You're not allowed to plow a field with an ox and a donkey harnessed together, pulling the plow. Because I saw a giraffe, two of them, and an elephant, harnessed together, pulling a circus wagon. The first question, if we take it from the beginning, is this permitted, or is it forbidden? If we say it's permitted, then we will, in effect, be saying that when the Torah says, don't plow with an ox and a donkey, it means specifically plowing with an ox and a donkey. No connection to elephants and giraffes pulling a circus wagon. But if we say it's forbidden, which, by the way, it is, then maybe, but not definitely yet, there is a connection. So now the speculation. Is this forbidden because we perceive that this is cruel to either the elephant or the giraffes or both, harnessing them together to pull a load? In which case, it would fall under the halachic concept of avoiding tsar balei chayim, cruelty to animals. And as such, it would explain why this would be forbidden. Or do we say more? Do we say that the prohibition of the Torah against plowing with an ox and a donkey is to be extended to include any two animals, or certainly two non-compatible animals with different strengths and temperaments in performing any function? In other words, not just, well, let's start from the beginning, not ignoring the elephant and the giraffes because they're not an ox and a donkey, that we reject. Considering this in the framework of kindness to animals to avoid doing this, that would be one step. To actually tie it to lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav, not to plow with an ox and a donkey together, is more, because it's saying that we draw from the prohibition in the Torah to apply to other animals and other functions. when in fact we actually go one very crucial step further. And this is my point, which I will repeat in different examples, and each one in its own little different way. Because it is forbidden to harness an elephant and giraffes to pull a circus wagon. It is not only tsa'ar balei chayim, cruelty to animals, and that's a rationale for its prohibition. It is not only an extension of the Torah's prohibition of donkey and ox plowing, but it is a Torah violation of lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachtav. When the Torah says, thou shalt not plow with an ox and a donkey together, it means that you're not allowed by Torah law to pull a circus wagon with an elephant and giraffes harnessed together. This is not merely rabbinic legislation inspired by the Torah. It is part of the Torah law. It is not derabanan, of rabbinic origin. It is deoraita, Torah law. Now, where do I get that? The Torah only mentions ox and donkey plowing. The oral law teaches us that plowing and ox and donkey are terms used as an example only from a broader, more encompassing prohibition of harnessing two animals together to perform any task. I'll say it again, this is significantly more than calling it a rabbinic legislation inspired by the Torah's law. But if the written word of the Torah only mentions ox and donkey and plowing, where do we get the notion that on a Torah prohibition level, it includes elephant and giraffes pulling a circus wagon? The answer is Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. And this is my point, which I will repeat, that the Jews' view of Torah, and I hesitate not because I don't believe what I'm about to say, but because I can't prove it as much as I can say this is a very essential part of our belief, trust, confidence in the chain of tradition. When our sages teach us that Torah law includes the written word and the oral law as passed down through the generations, then these become an inseparable unit. You cannot understand Lo Tacharosh B'Shor V'Chamor Yachdav without the body of law called Torah Sheba'al Peh. The oral law is essential to understanding properly and not distorting that which the Torah commands. Side point, I happen to have been looking on a website, don't ask me how I got there, which was a Christian sermon for children, and it mentioned there very plainly that the Christian view seems to be that before the time of Jesus, the God of the Israelites had commanded a very strict and cruel Torah, which included the right of a person to pluck out his enemy's eye in retribution for his having his eye plucked out. And you could punch out a guy's tooth if he punches out your tooth, because the Bible says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And they claimed that it was only the teachings of Jesus that changed the status, which is total nonsense, because the Jewish perspective on an eye for an eye has always been that it is not, God forbid, the literal plucking out of an eye in exchange for that injury, but it is a complex system of monetary compensation which takes into account pain and medical bills and lost earnings and embarrassment and all kind of nuances which are summed up by the expression an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, teaching various nuances of the way the law is interpreted. And even the word interpret I should not have used, but it's the way the law is defined. Anybody that says that Judaism or that God's Torah teaches that you pluck out an eye in retribution for an eye plucked out is distorting the word of God, is distorting and perverting what the Torah says. Let's get back to the circus wagon, the elephants, the giraffes, the ox, and the donkey. If a person or a sect of Judaism were to reject the teaching of the oral law, which there have been and are, then you leave it up to, I don't know what, speculation, legislation, or whatever, to how to interpret Lo Tacharosh Beshor Uvechamor Yachdav. But that's not the true Torah way. The true Torah way says the written word is part of the story. The oral law explains and defines and tells us what the written word means. Before I move on to another example, let us not dismiss Dr. Seuss without saying that this picture of the elephant and the giraffes pulling the circus wagon with the trailer behind it does not actually depict a Torah violation, simply because this was in the boy's imagination and not in reality. So that's just a side point and a little tongue-in-cheek, but that's the whole story from this particular episode or pages of Dr. Seuss. Another topic, also from Parshat Ki Teitzeh. Question, what is the proper procedure in handling Jewish dead, the dead body of a Jew? Answer, burial in the ground. Answer, burial in the ground with dispatch, to do it as quickly as is feasible, not to leave the body without burial. Other methods of disposing of a body, such as cremation, forbidden by Jewish law. Okay. Is this Torah law or is it rabbinic law? Answer, it is Torah law. Okay, if it is Torah law, where does it say so? Well, in the beginning of Parshat Ki Teitzeh, it says the following. If a person shall be judged guilty of a capital offense, let's take an example, idolatry, public idol worship, with witnesses and warning and testimony, clear, person is found guilty by the smaller Sanhedrin of 23 in his city, and the sentence is death by stoning. The Torah says that after the execution takes place, the person's body is to be hung on a post for a brief period before sunset, then removed and buried in the ground with, by the way, the hanging post as well. Again, hanging is not a method of execution in Jewish law. It is a procedure that follows execution in certain kind of situations and crimes and sins. In that context, the Torah says you must bury the body. Our oral law teaches us that this is the method of disposing, I don't like that word, of treating all Jewish dead, burial. And the oral law says, don't view this merely as rabbinic legislation inspired by the Torah. Sort of like an argument like this. If the Torah says we have to bury even an executed criminal who was guilty, tried, and convicted, and sentenced, and executed for a terrible sin, how much more so, since the Torah seems to indicate that this is a a sign of respect to the human form, even in such a case, how much more so should we do that for all people? In fact, we know way earlier in the Torah that Avram Avinu spent considerable time and money to take care of the burial of Sarah Imenu, Sarah, his wife. Neither of those ideas, the logical reasoning called Kal Vachomer, or the anecdotal material from Avraham and Sarah, necessarily label the requirement of Jewish burial as a Torah law. It is the oral law that teaches us that it is part and parcel of the definition of the Torah's command to bury the convicted, executed, etc., etc. And therefore, when you look in, let's say, Sefer HaChinuch, which is a work on the 613 mitzvot, you will see it sort of split by saying, this mitzvah number, or whatever it is the mitzvah to bury he who had been executed and hanged and hung in the ground, and so too all Jewish dead. But it is Torah law, not in the written word per se, but it is Torah law nonetheless, because it comes from the oral law. That is no less d'oraita, no less Torah commanded than if it would be written. Written and oral Torah are on the same level. Let me go back a step to the ox and the donkey, because there is an important component of that discussion that needs to be said. When the oral law tells us ox, just an example, but it extends to other animals. Donkey, just an example. Plowing, just an example, but it extends to other things. Then we accept that because we are taught that by the Talmud, by the oral law. We cannot necessarily extend that reasoning to other areas. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on www.ouradio.com. Before we continue, have a listen.
I need
One of the Shabbat Zmirot to put us into the Shabbat mood from an album called Amit. We were talking about the warning not to generalize from something that we are taught from the oral law. Of course, that's too much of a generalization itself, but that's another issue. When we are taught that donkey is not necessarily just a donkey, remember that there are other contexts in the Torah where the word chamor, donkey, is used, and it is very exclusive. For example, the firstborn of a donkey has certain procedures, pidyon, peter, chamor, which apply only to a donkey, not to a firstborn horse, not to a firstborn camel or a dog or a cat or anything else. Sometimes the word chamor is a generic term, sometimes it is a very narrow, exclusive, specific term. So you have to be very careful if you learn that something includes others in the same category. And remember, we're not talking about rabbinic legislation and extension. We're talking about part of the definition of a word. The word yom is sometimes daytime as opposed to nighttime. And in other mitzvot, it is a 24-hour period. Zachorit yom ha-shabbat l'kadsho, to remember the Sabbath day, refers to the entire Shabbat. That's the mitzvah of Kiddush on Friday night. But Uvayom Hashmini Imol Bisar Orlato was the command to circumcise a boy on the eighth day. And there we are taught that it means day and not night. Ulakachtem Lachem Bayom Harishon, take the lulav and etrog on the first day of Sukkot, not at nighttime, daytime only. So the word yom and many, many other words can be both inclusive and exclusive. There's a beautiful, remarkable illustration of this in one parsha, one little tiny portion of the Torah, the one that contains Lo tacharosh b'shoru v'chamor yachtav, not to plow with an ox and a donkey together, contains in the very following verse Lo tilbash sha'atnez, don't wear shatnez. What is that? Tzemer ufishtim yachtav. Lo tacharosh, don't plow, or any other function. Lo tilbash, do not wear exclusively. The prohibition applies to wearing. Bishor uvachamor yachdav, with an ox and a donkey together, or any other two animals together. Tzemer ufishtim yachdav, wool and linen together, only wool and linen. Nothing else is part of that prohibition. So within this tiny parsha of two topics that are related in that they both forbid some level of mixture, we have the opposites as far as applicability. Okay, here's another example. The Torah tells us when the court finds a person guilty of a corporal offense, one that is punishable by 39 lashes, by the way, before a person receives 39 lashes, he's examined by doctors to determine if he could handle 39 lashes. 39 lashes were not meant to kill a person. So the doctors determine, based on age and physical constitution and health experience, etc., etc., let's say they say this guy can't get more than 10 lashes. 10 would be okay, but not more. So the Sanhedrin reduces it to 9. Number has to be divisible by 3 for certain reasons, and they won't go more than the 10. They give him only 9 lashes, and he is freed from the obligation of having received 39. If the court says this guy can't handle any, he could die from a single lash, then he's off the hook, and it's considered as if he got the lashes that he was supposed to. But that's a side point. Here is the point. Arba'im yakenu lo yosif is the prohibition of giving more than the lashes that he's supposed to receive. Pen yosif lahakoto al eila, makor rabba, maybe he'll go excessively, v'nikla achicha le'inecha. All right, the point is that the Torah in the written word prohibits administering one lash more than you're supposed to. The oral law teaches us that it is from this mitzvah that we are commanded, prohibited, to strike another person. Punching the guy in the nose, not as one more lash than he deserves, but just punching him in the nose, is a prohibition in the Torah from this pasuk. Here is another example. When the context of the mitzvah is narrow, the applicability is broad, and it is Torah Sheba'al Peh that teaches us. This is repeatedly the case. The words in the Torah don't give you the full picture, and they're not meant to give you the full picture. I've quoted in earlier shows the Medrash and Medrash Peliya collection of Midrashim, which says that when God dictated to Moshe, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, don't cook a baby goat in its mother's milk, and explained to Moshe the laws of milk and meat which he was to transmit to the people, Moshe asked God for permission to write meat in milk. The understanding being that it would be easier to explain to people and understand if it would say something like, do not cook milk and meat together, or do not eat milk and meat mixtures together, then using the enigmatic phrasing of Gedi b'chalev imo. God said to Moshe, write these words which I dictate to you. In other words, it is purposely done by God in the written Torah that it is not literally understandable. It is not always clear. It is very often not clear what the Torah means, and you need Torah Sheba'al Peh. The need for Torah Sheba'al Peh also means the need for a teacher, the need for one generation transmitting to the next generation, and that's the whole story. That makes it a living Torah, and it's not written in stone. Or to qualify that, to borrow that expression, but to qualify it, only the Aseret HaDibrot were written in stone. The rest of the written word is written in parchment, and the rest of the Torah is transmitted orally from one generation to the next, and it has been committed to writing and printing, but it still retains the essence of the oral law. Here's another track from that Amit album, the Yizku Lirot Banim. Please, please, Here's another example, maybe, in my opinion, the best example of the inaccuracy of words, we'll say, the dual nature of some words being inclusive sometimes and exclusive at other times, and the definite need of the Torah Shebaal Peh to tell us which. It's a classic example. I've given it before. This is the Parsha Ki Teitzei. Let's do it again. The Torah says, Ki Yeshevu Achim Yachdav Umeit Achad Mehen Uvein Ein Lo. When brothers live together and one of them dies and he has no ben. Leave that word in Hebrew for the moment. Lo Tehiyeh Eshet HaMeit HaChutza LeIsh Zar. The widow of the deceased brother shall not be allowed to marry anyone from the outside, but rather Yivama Yavo Aleha Ulakacha Lo LeIsha VeYibima. Her Yavam, which is her deceased husband's brother, takes her as a wife and performs this special marriage known as Yibum. The Torah continues, V'haya ha-bechor asher teleid, the firstborn that will be born from this union, Yakum al-shem achiv hamet, will follow the name of the deceased brother of the new father, V'lo yimachesh mo mi-Yisrael, and his name will not be erased from Israel. The Torah then continues on the details. If this is not to be consumed as a marriage called Yibum, it's to be severed by the divorce-like proceeding called Chalitza. Let's leave the details out. Let's go back to the word we left in Hebrew. Brothers living together, one of them dies. And by the way, the fact that the brothers live together or not is irrelevant here. Even if you have to track down the deceased brother to the other end of the earth, he still has to perform Yibum or Chalitza. A brother dies, a man dies, without a ben. Question. Just picture the scenario of an ancient village in biblical Israel, where this happens for the very first time. Here is the young widow, and she comes before the Beit Din of the town, the elders of the town, to ask what she's supposed to do. And let's say, in this hypothetical, they had a daughter, one girl, and the man died. So the town elders sit. This is, of course, without the oral law. They sit with the written word. And one of them says the following. Well, if you take a look at the wording in the Torah, the purpose of Yibum is to produce a son that will follow in the name or be named for the deceased man, so his name shall not be eliminated from Israel. Therefore, the fact that he has a daughter does not give him that namesake. And therefore, I suggest that when the Torah says, Uvein Ein Lo, that it means he has no son. And the fact that he has a daughter is irrelevant. Another guy could argue that Bein is inclusive to include all offspring, male and female alike, son and daughter. And they would argue. But I tell you the argument, the logic of the first guy fits better. And yet, that's not the halacha. If a man and a woman have a daughter, and the man dies, and the woman marries his brother, they are in violation of one of the incestuous relationships in the Torah that is forbidden under penalty of death. If a man and a woman have no children at all, and the man dies, then not only is his widow allowed to marry his brother, it is a big mitzvah that if the mitzvah is not to be performed, it need be severed by the ceremony, the relationship need be severed by the ceremony of Chalitza. So here you're talking about no middle ground. You're talking about a mitzvah, if you interpret the word bein correctly, and a very, very serious sin if you interpret it wrongly. If the town elders in that hypothetical situation were to allow that woman to marry her husband's brother, they would be committing a terrible, terrible sin. How do you know what ben means? How do you know if it's exclusive or inclusive? Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's my point. That's been my point since I started. That's what I chose to express from Parshat Ki Teitzeh. There is much, much more in this Sedra, but this will have to suffice since our time is running out. And I hope that those examples, and there are others, I use the example of milk and meat, I started to anyway, we didn't get too far with that, but that would be from other Sedras. This is all over the Torah like that. You cannot understand the Torah without Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Torah says eat matzah at the Seder, very nice. Where's the recipe? In Torah Sheba'al Peh, etc., etc., etc. I have one more idea to add to this picture that we've been painting on mitzvot, one aspect of mitzvot, but let's have a listen to another song, this one from an album called Class One. I think it's sort of like first class music, and the song comes from the introductory passage that the congregation says before Birchat Kohanim, the blessing of the Kohanim on Yom Tov. And it expresses a longing to see the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash, and to see the function of the Beit HaMikdash continue speedily in our time. another part of the story with these mitzvot is where we do find rabbinic legislation. Take another example from Parshat Ki Teitzeh. You have a positive command to build a protective fence, a parapet, a ma'akeh, around a roof. We're talking about a flat roof where people can go up there. Not one of the pointy roofs where people can't stay on them. Then the obligation wouldn't be there. But there's an obligation if you have a habitable roof to build a ma'akeh. This is partnered with a lo ta'aseh, a prohibition. V'lo tasim damim beveitecha, don't leave blood in your household, meaning make sure that your roof is constructed in such a way that nobody could fall down. But it means more than that. Now, our sages explain to us that the Torah prohibition goes beyond one's roof. In other words, having a roof without a ma'akeh is a hazard, and therefore it's forbidden in addition to the command to build the ma'akeh. But if you have, let's say, a swimming pool in your backyard, whether it has water in it or not, you must put a fence around it or a cover to prevent someone from falling into it. If you have a rickety set of stairs with no railing, that's forbidden by Torah law to leave in that condition. That is not necessarily the fulfillment of ma'akeh when you do take the measure to cover the pool. In other words, no one is claiming that putting a cover on a swimming pool is a fulfillment of the positive command to build a ma'akeh. But we are saying that putting the cover on the pool and other things like it is a Torah mitzvah to avoid the violation of the prohibition of v'lo tasim damim beveitecha. So that's an example like others that we've had earlier in the show. But now let's take it a step further. There are many things that Chazal, our sages, forbid us to do in the spirit of the mitzvah of ma'akeh and its negative, its partner prohibition of leaving a hazard in your home. Let me repeat that idea to make sure where we got this right. The written word in the Torah says, build a protective fence around your roof, so that you shall not, or, and you shall not, leave a hazard in your home and in your land. So the narrowest way to read that is you've got a positive command to build the ma'akeh, a prohibition against leaving it without building a ma'akeh. In other words, two sides of the same coin, overlapping mitzvot, perfect overlap, but that's not the case because it's more than that. The building of the ma'akeh refers to your roof. The prohibition of v'lo tasim damim beveitecha applies to other similar kinds of hazards. If a person is on the roof and there's no ma'akeh, he could fall off and get killed or get hurt. If the swimming pool is uncovered, a person could fall in and hurt himself or get killed. If the stairs are this, if the, whatever the hazard, electrical wires that are bare, a person could touch it and electrocute himself. That would be consistent with the Torah definition for v'lo tasim damim beveitecha, which is broader than just being the flip side prohibition related to the building of a ma'akeh. Came the sages and they ran with the ball. They said, we, by the authority given to us in the Torah and by the authority that is based on, or not that it's based on, but that gives them permission and instructions and encouragement to legislate as they see fit to go along with the spirit of the mitzvot from the Torah. Here they said, obviously the Torah wants us to protect ourselves and others from hazards. And therefore, in Shulchan Aruch, you can find it is forbidden to drink from a pond at night because you can't see what's in it and you could swallow a harmful thing. It is forbidden to put money in your mouth. The way the Shulchan Aruch describes it is because the saliva of a dangerously ill person could have been on the money and dried, and by putting it in your mouth, you reactivate it. Translate that into more modern terms, and we're talking germs. Now, interesting, putting coins in between your lips while you're fumbling from change is not only something that your mother tells you not to do, it is a prohibition of rabbinic nature, written in Shulchan Aruch, based upon and inspired by the pasuk in this week's Sedra that prohibits leaving hazards in your homes and in your land. That's part of it. Certainly, secondary smoking fits into this scenario as well. But to go in that direction, we'd have to bring up the topic of primary smoking, which is no doubt a prohibition in the Torah. So let's not even get into there. But certainly when the person next to you was smoking, he is endangering others, and that's forbidden by the Torah and by the rabbis. There's a lot more, but I tend to say that every week anyway, so let's call it a show. Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Ki Teitzeh, towards the end of 5766. Wishing you all a Shabbat Shalom, a meaningful and good month of Elul, Lehishtameah. But don't go away yet, we got some fun coming up.
Humble servitude be of assistance.
And finally, a few selections from a book called 1001 Smiles. Our best thoughts usually come to us in situations where it is impossible either to write them down or to impress someone by speaking them aloud. And how about this one? Two wrongs don't make a right, but three lefts do.